I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, we are back. It is June. And based on the lack of comments or likes or reactions to the post, I don't think Lou Anders is still listening.
No, that's okay. I understand. Hey, man, you know, pod fading and all that. Although we didn't pod fade.
Didn't pod fade. He listener faded.
He listen faded. Lou.
Yeah.
We're going to get an angry email from him now anyway. No, it's okay. It is what it is. Today, Patrick, joined by old friend. Well, he's not old, but, you know, a friend, a longtime friend of the show, Max Gladstone.
Just keep digging.
Yeah, keep going. He's got a brand new book out called Empress of Forever. And we're here to talk a little bit about the book as well as other things and catch up with Max. Max, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, John, Patrick. Real pleasure to be back on the podcast.
I wanted to bring this up at the top of the show because I've read several books in Max's previous series of books, or I don't know if that's an ongoing series still, your craft sequence books, which we can get into that a bit. I've read the first two or three in that, and I remember I wrote like a little review of it on Goodreads or Amazon or whatever. Just I'm not good about that these days. I know it's like, you got to review your author's book so you can help them out, you know, but it was in a phase when I was still doing that. And I feel like I put something along the lines of, you know, this book is kind of like the pain medication that you get when you get your wisdom teeth pulled out and like just like all these kind of trippy things. And I'm looking at one of the blurbs. I think it's on the Barnes & Noble's Best Books for June website it ends with like Guardians of the Galaxy on mescaline. And it's so funny because we've had Max on the show a few times, and I gather Max not doing a lot of mescaline and prescription drugs and things. I don't know, you in your private life, you could do what you want, Max, but I think it's funny that that seems to be something that comes up a lot when your books are reviewed, is this sort of trippy, otherworldly kind of thing. Why do you think that is? Why do you think people describe it in that way?
That's a great question. In my personal life, I'm pretty boring, to be entirely honest. I drink a little bit of whiskey every now and again and a lot of coffee. But outside of that, I've never been particularly a hard user of anything. But it might have something to do with the fact that I grew up reading a lot of 60s and 70s SF. Zelazny was really influential to me. A lot of the other sort of fantasists and science fiction writers coming out of that period. And that was a moment of intense formal experimentation in the science fiction and fantasy genre. It was the sort of transition between what, I don't know, I'm not really a terribly great genre historian, so I'm going to say some stuff and then people are going to get angry at me in the comments, and I apologize for that in advance. But I have a sense of like a kind of clear-eyed, Gernsback-ish sort of style doesn't really matter. What we're trying to do is pose a science fictional question or get into and out of the conceit of a story very quickly, vision for science fiction. And then there was this period where, I'm forgetting the author's name. Guy wrote Gun with Occasional Music. Jonathan Lethem talks about this in an essay, where he talks about how in the sort of 50s through the 70s, there was a dramatic turn in American letters away from having any kind of interesting stylistic flourish. That's not even really, sorry, the right way to put it. It's more like people spent a lot of time trying to write very clear, very clean, very pared down prose, the kinds that I think Raymond Carver tends to get identified with. There was a lot of domestic realism, a lot of internal focus, and if you were interested in doing anything stylistically wacky or strange, you ended up in science fiction in the US, which is where that stuff would be published. So that's where people like Zelazny and Dick and Delaney are all writing in science fiction because they love it, but they're also writing in science fiction because that's the kind of place where they can stretch their wings to fullest extent. So I grew up reading and loving those books and loving their use of allusion, their use of literary form, reference. And it's just the sheer gonzo pace of them, which is something that I think we've kind of stepped away from in the last 20, 30 years. Lord of Light by itself, let alone something like Creatures of Light and Darkness, these books pack what we would stretch out over entire epic narratives, like 6-book series now, into something that barely qualifies as a novel according to the Hugo categories. That just bravura, flourishing storytelling using suggestion, inference, vast summary. It's so exciting, and it really drew me to the genre. And so I think that's part of where it comes from, that's where my roots go pretty far down and deep into. And those aren't the other only people I'm drawing from, but I think a kind of heady use of language is something that I also really love, coupled with core story, really, like really strong driving storytelling beats. So I'm rereading Dorothy Dunnett's Game of Kings and her Lyman Chronicles right now. They just got a re-release from Vintage, beautiful new editions. And that's, again, that feeling of kind of phantasmorgia with the language and strong cause and effect storytelling with an epic swashbuckling conceit in the kind of narrative spine. That's a very rambling answer to your question.
No, it's good. I think writing is, it's something that's sometimes overlooked in genre or not talked about as much or not stressed as much. Because I think about that, in the past year, I'm still not good at it, but I, whether it's a book or a TV series or a movie, I have this value that I'm trying to live where I give myself permission to quit. I would never quit things. I would never quit them. If it was a book and I started it, and if I made it 10 pages in, I was going to finish it no matter what. And not even allowing myself, I'm trying to have that value of quitting. Someone on another podcast I listen to, it's this value of like quit more to read more, meaning if you're really slogging through something, it kind of, you know, it really kills your momentum and your joy of reading if you're slogging through it. But I bring that up because there was a book I recently quit that I made 200 pages into. I was really trying not to quit it because there were things about it that I liked. It was a fantasy novel, you know, published by one of the major publishers, and I really liked the world building a lot, but I didn't feel any connection to the characters, and I didn't care for the writing. And a lot of times there are many books that I read where maybe there's not a lot going on plot wise, and maybe there's not a lot going on world building, but the characters are great and the writing just really snaps, and it's just like beautiful writing. And to me, that can really carry a book for me, is great writing and great characterization. That a lot of times I'm fine. You know, if that's what it is, you know,
absolutely. I'm nodding along over here.
Yeah. Well, I think of when I think about that, and I know it's brought up a lot, I think about Becky Chambers books. I forget the names of the series.
Close and Common Orbit. Yeah. Slow Way, Long Way to a Small Angry Planet, I think is the first one.
Yeah. Those are science fiction books, kind of world building, sort of like Firefly or something, because that's the shorthand that we all use for that kind of thing. But
right.
not much plot in those, but boy, do I love the characters and I love her writing. So I just read all those books because I love them. I just think it really carries the way for me. So
for sure. A friend of mine refers to those as sort of coffee shop AU books that just happen to be set in space. And they have all of the genre tropes and toolkit available to them that any science fiction novel would have, but they're really interested in character dynamic a lot more than they're interested in plot-wise cause and effect or anything like that. And that's real. It feels like it's a real comfortable and cool space. I'm glad those books are in the genre.
Me too. Cool. Well, you know, before we get on to our next segment, I want to take a minute to thank everybody that backs the podcast, that supports us every month. We couldn't do the show without you. So thank you so much for backing us over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. If you're not already backing us, consider becoming one of our patrons. Again, patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can do $1 a month. Anything helps. It makes a difference for us. It helps us get cool guests like Max on the show, and it helps us keep going. So once again, patreon.com/functionalnerds. Now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
Max, why don't you go first? What's your pick?
Oh, sure. So this is a little bit of an old one, but I've been spending so much time on this game in the last couple of months that I can't not choose it. So I think this is White Wizard Games has a game called Star Realms, which was made basically as an attempt to do a single box Magic the Gathering alike. You have you and another player both take the sides of competing space empires, and it's sort of a deck builder like Dominion in that you start with a small deck of cards that are not particularly good, like some of them that generate money and some of them that generate hit points or attack points that you're using to attack your opponent. And then there is a row of cards between you that are of different factions, and each of them has a cost associated with them and can do things like get you to draw more cards or do damage or defend you against damage. And this game is just absurdly addictive. In its like one-on-one format, just played live, it's an enormous amount of fun, and my wife and I play it together all the time. But specifically, you can get it on your phone, and there are an infinite number of expansions for this thing at this point. You could spend there are 15, I think, different expansions that range from a few cards to a whole new decks that you can play this thing with. But I just spend sometimes hours playing the playing against the artificial intelligence. It's like the best solitaire game that I've ever played. It's got a little bit of this random number generation situation where when you get good enough at the game, you can see within the first 5 or 6 moves who's likely to win. But there's always that chance that you'll be able to put your deck together just right and eke out a victory, even though the odds are like 90% against you. It's an enormous amount of fun, and it plays in maybe 10 minutes at the outside. So if you're hanging out on the subway or you're, I don't know, waiting for the water to boil for tea or something, it's great to pull out and just mess with. I love it, and it's a great time spender.
Say the name one more time.
Star Realms is the name.
Cool. Patrick, have you heard of that one before?
I have not. At first, I thought he was talking about Star Frontier, which is an old TSR role-playing game that was...
Oh, no, yeah.
Completely different, but no, I haven't heard of that one. Sounds cool though.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, the other thing that I really like about it, which I didn't mention before, is if you're, you know, setting aside the phone game, the game itself fits entirely in like one UltiPro deck box. So, nice. You know, tiny little deck of cards sized, two decks of cards together sized box. So if you're looking for a game that's two player but fills a similar role to something like Love Letter, where you can keep it in your shoulder bag and be able to pop it out and have a quick game of something with anybody at any time, this is a great pick.
Very cool.
Cool. Patrick, what's your pick this week?
My pick is a documentary that I saw on Netflix. It's called The Battered Bastards of Baseball. And have you ever heard of an actor named Kurt Russell?
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay. So his dad was Bing, and Bing wanted to be a professional baseball player, but he got hurt very early on in his career, and it ended his career in baseball. So he moved the family to California, and he became an actor. And in just about every Western you've ever seen from that period, like the late 50s, 60s kind of era, when the guy in the black hat kind of gets dramatically shot, a lot of times it's Bing. And he eventually became the sheriff on Bonanza. So he was the sheriff on Bonanza for like 13 years. And it was just like Kurt described him as he was just a working actor. You just got up, you went to work, you worked all day, you came home. And that's just what he did every single day. Well, he still loved baseball, and he would he would work with Kurt on baseball and playing baseball. And so Kurt played baseball, you know, as a kid and into high school and stuff. And he would write books. He would make movies. And Kurt was like the star of the movies about how to properly be an infielder, how to properly be an outfielder, like what you should be doing, how you should pivot and throw. Like, he was really, really into baseball. Wow. So come the 70s, and I believe it's Spokane. It's either Spokane or Portland. I'm blanking on that now, and I apologize. Had a triple-A team and called the Beavers. And they decided they weren't getting any, there was no attendance, they were not making any money. And the National Baseball League they said, we're done. We're not gonna have a team here anymore. And they opened up that market, and Bing bought the territory and went there and created an independent baseball team that was not associated with any major league team. And they were the Mavericks. And this is their story, the battered bastards of baseball. And it talks about how they basically proved that you don't need to be associated with a major league team in order to survive. They were getting more people coming to their games than were going to major league baseball games.
Oh, wow.
And eventually what happened was Major League Baseball said, we're done with this. We're going to kill them. We're going to crush them. And like the second half of this documentary is sort of that story. The first half is Bing building up this team, all the popularity, you know, bringing baseball back to this town. Everybody loves them except Major League Baseball. And it's just a really interesting kind of human interest story. I didn't even know that Kurt Russell played for the team. So he's this actor. We know he did all the Disney films, right?
Yeah.
As a kid and then a teenager. And then he started doing more adult roles. But at some point in the middle, he played for the Mavericks.
Oh, my gosh.
He was on that team. And he was part of that team with his dad.
That's amazing.
It's a great story. It's just a great story. So even if you don't like baseball, go watch this. It's a great story.
Cool. Yeah, a lot of times docs are like that. It's like, even if you're not that interested in the subject, if it's well done, if it's a good story, you can get into it.
Yeah, because you learn so much that you never knew. Like, I didn't know anything. I didn't know that the sheriff on Bonanza was Kurt Russell's dad.
Yes, I did not know that either.
I didn't know that.
Cool. My pick this week, I have a bunch that I want to do, but I'm going to go with this one because I've read most of the new canon Star Wars books, and I've been not as enthusiastic about them over the past year or so. I was someone that really bought into the fact that they were going to try to, connect those to the movies and the TV shows more than they kind of subsequently have. Some of them have, but especially in the past year or two, they have not. And so I've not been as enthusiastic about them as I once was, but the most recent one that I went through, I liked a lot. And that is Star Wars Dooku Jedi Lost. So it's about Count Dooku. And first of all, I think this one really worked for me, at least anyway, for two reasons. It is an audio only book. There's no ebook or print copy of this book. This was an experiment where they wanted to do just an audio version. And because of that, it's a full cast recording. So there's, I don't know, 10 or 15 actors that are in on this. And it's a lot of the people that do the Star Wars books anyway. But I think whenever you have a full cast and if it's well done, that really adds something if you like audiobooks. So that's one reason. And I think the other reason why it works so well is because it's about Count Dooku, who is not really the main character in the series. And I think one of the reasons why the Star Wars books can sometimes suffer is because oftentimes the authors have great constraints put on them because, well, if you have a Han Solo book and you can only tell this 2-month period of his life and we know where he ends up later, it really kind of shackles you in terms of what you can do storytelling wise. Now, I think all the authors that have worked on Star Wars books have been great, and they sometimes they do great things within that format, sometimes it just leaves me wanting. I think Dooku's a great character to use because even though we know where he ends up and his role in two of the prequel movies, we don't really get his story at all in those movies. He's just kind of the villain in those movies. So this book basically tells his story from the time that he's a Padawan, because he was a Jedi, and why he sort of turns and what that becomes. So it's really well done. So you can kind of get to hear his story. So you get his arc. And I really liked it. And of course, I'm a big fan of the Clone Wars and Rebels and all that. So I like getting deep into some of the more minor characters. So if you're sort of that kind of deep Star Wars fan and you want to learn more about a more minor character, I think this is great. This is my favorite Star Wars book that I've read in a while. So that's it.
Dooku. I just always assumed that he found a Palantir and started using it in secret.
Mm.
And that's what turned him to the dark side.
It could be. Could be. Max, have you written a Star Wars book, like, or a short story or something? I feel like I saw your name connected with the Star Wars thing at some point. Do I have that wrong?
I don't think I've ever written a
Star Wars. You'd probably know if you did.
I probably would know if I had. No, I'm a huge fan of the universe, and I have somewhere around here every Star Wars comic that Dark Horse published on the label up until like 2003 or so. The Dark Horse, in my heart, but
the Dark Horse books were just wonderful. I like
them. They were
so much.
Amazing. The, yeah. I mean, the Knights of the Old Republic series. No, not what is it? Tales of the Jedi. That's it.
Tales
Sorry.
Of the Jedi. Yeah.
Yeah, the original Tales of the Jedi sort of trilogy arc is just one of the best expansions of Star Wars material that I've ever seen. And really, for my mind, the Dark Horse comics did a lot of the yeoman's work of expanding the sense of what a Star Wars story could be, paving the way then for stories like Knights of the Old Republic and the Star Wars online games, things like that. It's just, there's so much more galaxy there than this 20-year period.
Which one was it with the Padawan who all the masters killed the Padawans and he goes on the run?
Oh gosh, yeah, that was after I stopped collecting, but that's...
Oh really? Okay.
Yeah.
Because I felt like that was Tales of the Jedi, but I could be wrong.
Well,
I have them here somewhere.
Yeah. So Tales of the Jedi starts with Ulic Quel-Drama. It's that story, Ulic Quel-Drama and Nomi Sunrider, right? So it gets you to Onderon. You see the Beast Lords of Onderon. There's the sort of shocking turn of events where it turns out the people that they've come here to help are actually dark side sorcerers or whatever. So they side with the beasts, kick them out. Ulic slowly falls to the dark side. Exar Kun shows up. All that kind of stuff. Galactic War ensues. It's one of those where I just kept being, I guess I didn't have any real connection to comics news at the time. So I kept being shocked each time there'd be a new huge development. Like, oh my gosh, this is just getting so much bigger than I thought. They were just going to tell a sort of contained Star Wars story with some Jedi that we hadn't heard of before. No, this is like a cosmic thing.
I haven't thought about those character names in forever, because I read some of those comics and I read all, like, Exar Kun shows up in the Kevin J. Anderson Star Wars books. I guess were those first the books or were the comics first?
I think the comics, I forget where the character came from, to be entirely honest. I feel like the comics came out first just because the KJA trilogy came out after Dark Empire. And Dark Empire was, I think, after the Tales of the Jedi series was out. But I honestly don't know. That might have been one of those situations where a story group at Lucasfilm or LucasArts all had some, like, there's this guy, Exar Kun, on a post-it note somewhere, and everybody was kind of developing it at the same time.
Well, because I think in the comics, like, those comics take place thousands of years before, like, the main timeline.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Then... the Kevin J. Anderson books were like those Jedi Academy books that took place after the original trilogy. So I think Exar Kun was sort of like a spirit that was inhabiting somebody or something.
Yeah, totally. So there was, let me see if I can get this straight in my head. And of course, Wikipedia would be the place to go for accurate information with all this, or Wikipedia. But so Exar Kun shows up in Kevin J. Anderson's Jedi Academy trilogy, which as a sort of dark side spirit that's inhabiting the temple on the forest moon of Yavin, where Luke Skywalker sets up his Jedi training academy. Mm-hmm. And the Tales of the Jedi series, eventually that character shows up as a young kind of force-sensitive archaeologist who's going around the galaxy collecting Sith artifacts, and then he gets either returned to the dark side or possessed, or really sort of bargains with his soul, basically, to get power from a force ghost named Frida Nod, and then gets access to an ancient Sith armada and goes around trying to conquer the universe, and is sort of draws to the dark side. Yulequel Drama, who's a Jedi Knight that we've known for a little while. So very tragic, heartrending, big galactic stuff. And Anderson, let me see. The thing that I remember about the sort of genesis of the Jedi Academy trilogy was being struck by Anderson having a lot of the world sort of set up. He kind of knew the story he wanted to tell. He had the outline put together. And then the Dark Empire comic series came out at Dark Horse. And Dark Empire was this vision of the Star Wars galaxy about 5 years or so after the Heir to the Empire trilogy. So maybe, I forget exactly how long that is, ABY. A while after Return of the Jedi anyway, in which the Emperor's evil clone has taken up control of the Imperial remnants at the center of the galaxy and has launched a sort of vicious, no holds barred, brutal war against the New Republic. So rather than this peaceful, flourishing galaxy that was then going to become under threat by, evil force ghosts, you had Kevin J. Anderson inheriting, after the Dark Empire series, a kind of broken galaxy that was heavily rebuilding after a cataclysmic war. And he's like, I thought this was actually a more interesting story to tell, so I went into that direction. It sort of stuck with me.
Yeah. Yeah, you bring that up because in the same article that has your new book as one of the picks for June, they're talking about an upcoming Star Wars book called Alphabet Squadron, written by Alexander Freed, which I'm excited about this one too, because I read Alexander Freed's Battlefront book, which I liked a lot. Again, because there's no main characters in it; it's all just different ones. So I think that gives you some more to play with. I think he actually did the novelization of Rogue One as well. So Alphabet Squadron is supposed to be right after Return of the Jedi, and it's supposed to be like this elite New Republic squadron. It's called Alphabet Squadron because there's like an A-wing fighter and a B-wing fighter and an X-wing, as you can imagine.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's
so great. It's going to be that, and that's what the novel's going to be about. But I thought this was interesting. They're kind of along the lines of what you were just saying. There's going to be a flip side. So this is going to be a novel, the Alphabet Squadron. There's going to be a flip side where there's going to be a comic called TIE Fighter, and it's going to be the same story, but told from the point of view of like this, remnants of the Imperials that are like this ragtag bunch of TIE fighter pilots that are against. Ooh, so I guess it's going to be the same story, one told from the New Republic side, one told from the remnants of the Empire side, but it's focused on these fighter pilots. So
that could be very cool. I think Dark Horse did something similar with two comic series. There was a short period where the Rogue Squadron comics and there was a TIE Fighter comic series at the same time were kind of operating against one another. Or at the very least, battles that Rogue Squadron won over here would be things that the TIE Fighter people had lost over here and then were recovering from. So a lot of potential there. It's interesting, though. I wonder how many crossover readers there are between the books and the comics.
It's hard to keep up with it. I think particularly the comics are, because they're published so frequently, and there's quite a few books now, and I haven't been keeping up with them. And I was, because I think a lot of people do, and Patrick and I talk about it quite a bit. I wait until they're published as a trade paperback when they, get, usually like, so I think you have a lot of people that wait for that, and it's really easy to miss those. And the next thing you know, oh, I'm quite a bit behind now. And if they do sort of, as a lot of the various books, they do interact to a certain extent. So you kind of want to read it in the proper order and everything. So I think the comics are a little harder to keep up with if you're not a going to the comic shop every week type of reader, which I think most of us were in some part of our lives, but many of us are not anymore. Patrick, you read a lot of comics on the iPad these days. Is that correct?
Yep.
And do you kind of do some of the Star Wars ones or not really?
I have. Yeah. The more recent ones. Again, I don't go back and look at the stuff that came before because it's pointless.
Yeah.
But I've gone through some of the newer stuff from Marvel, and you know, I grew up reading the Marvel Star Wars comics. I never particularly like loved them, but I read them because it was the only Star Wars we had. Mm-hmm. So kind of going back to those is not really interesting to me. But I've tried to keep up with some of the newer stuff. And like you said, I always grab the trade paperbacks when they're available. A good example of the difficulty with that is the Batman Beyond stuff.
Mm.
I discovered that there was a ton of Batman Beyond in the comics that took, you know, place after the show had gone off the air.
Mm.
And I started grabbing those and trying to read them. And there's nothing really on them to tell you what order to read them in.
Yeah.
And so I would start reading one and go, and they would start talking about, you know, the rift between Terry and Bruce. Well, where the hell is that? Wasn't in the last one. In the last one, they were getting along really well. And I was kind of going by publication date or trying to, and that just did not work. And so I had to go and basically go to Google and try to find a read order for Batman Beyond. And it jumps all over the place. It's like, read this one and then go read this one and then go read this one and then go read this one. And so I think that kind of gets difficult also with the Star Wars stuff, because there was a what's the doctor? The doctor.
Dr. Aphra?
Yeah. So in one, she's captured. And in the next one I got, they're already talking about how she escaped and she's off doing other things. And I couldn't find a trade paperback that showed where she escaped or how she escaped or what was going on.
I think of those as Marvel problems a lot, because Marvel just isn't really loves their crossovers. And
oh, yes.
Every single time I've become a regular Marvel subscriber, I've been into whatever character I'm into or whatever team book I'm into. And then 12 or 16 months pass and everything smashes into some enormous mess and Onslaught shows up and all of a sudden whatever was happening in Iron Man, Onslaught's happening. And then after Onslaught's done, we basically reset and then we go on with some other Iron Man stuff. All of the storylines and everything are dropped. I ran into the same problem you're describing with Batman Beyond when I was in high school trying to get a sense of what Hellblazer was, because I really liked the John Constantine character when he showed up in Sandman. And then I went out, and at that point, what was collected, I think the first 7 issues of Jamie Delano's run, the first 7 or 8 issues of Garth Ennis's run, and maybe 2 other, which was like 50 or 60 issues of the comic later, maybe 2 or 3 other trades were available, and that was it. So the Jamie Delano trade paperback ends on this enormous cliffhanger where John has just gone to war with some demon cult and enlisted the Swamp Thing to help out. And I just didn't know what happened with that outside of reading a Usenet post that was trying to fill everybody in on what was going on in between. But now, if you're into Hellblazer, you can just walk into the comic shop and they're all nicely numbered on the spine from 1 to like 73 or however many TPB volumes there are of that.
Yep. And just you're talking about the Marvel crossover thing. Did either of you read the recent articles talking about how Fox was trying to do a Avengers-type crossover before Marvel did it?
No.
So apparently, Fox was trying to do when in 2010, I believe, as the MCU was starting to ramp up, the executives at Fox commissioned a script because they were going to try to do a crossover event with all the characters that they had. So it was going to be X-Men, Deadpool, Fantastic Four, and some other little things that they had, and they actually had scripts written up and some other things, and it just never happened. But that was part of their plan. Like, they were going to try to do that before Marvel could get to the Avengers.
Huh.
And it just didn't happen.
Yeah.
That sounds really fortunate. Yeah.
But it's just interesting because that is so Marvel. That is exactly what Marvel does. And you have a lot of people who complain about the comic book movies now and all the attempts to do these big massive crossovers and have people appear. That is just what Marvel does every single day. And yep. And it works for them. You know, it's like, oh, this book is not doing so well right now in sales. Let's add Wolverine. Oh, suddenly we have a spike in sales. You know, let's do a little crossover.
I'm reminded, DC does it too. Yeah, I'm reminded describing it that way. Just add a little bit of Wolverine. I'm reading on Marvel Unlimited right now, The Age of Apocalypse, which I only read like a couple of issues on back when it was running.
I remember
that.
Stands.
And, you know, Dark Beast shows up in The Age of Apocalypse canon. I really love alternate timelines in X-Men because the one consistent beat is that everyone could be either a hero or like the most despicable fascist possible in any alternate timeline. Like there's no, Wolverine is basically the only consistent, doesn't trust anyone, is always basically a good guy, but anyone like the, you know, cuddly bunny in mainline Marvel continuity. Oh, Age of Apocalypse, cuddly murder bunny runs around peeling the flesh off of people. So Beast, who in the mainstream continuity is this like adorkable blue nerd guy who likes reading books with his feet and generally trying to do the right thing, is in Age of Apocalypse this like horrific Nazi experimenter kind of person, and literally, you know, goes around taking like this bit of gene out of this mutant and dropping it into his gene pool to try to recombine, breaking this person down for parts and recombining their parts into some other, you know, mutant monstrosity that he can send off to do his dire bidding. And I hadn't thought about it before, but that's a lot of, there's a lot of 90s Marvel in that. Are you going to put these three characters in a centrifuge and give one of them a techno-organic virus? And then, you know, that'll be a good character.
I remember that. Was the Age of Apocalypse where Wolverine lost a hand?
Yes.
Yeah, and he's running around with, he's only got the one hand, and he and Jean are together. And yeah, I remember that.
I have a coworker who likes all the Marvel movies and likes the Deadpool movies as well. And we were talking about Deadpool 2 because I had just watched it a couple weeks ago. And I was trying to explain Cable to her. Try explaining Cable to someone that doesn't have, you know, a couple years of the X-Men comics, 90s X-Men comic under your belt. Like, try and explain that way to someone who's like, all right, so you know Cyclops and Jean Grey? Okay, so Cable is their son from the future, but he's actually the most powerful mutant. And the reason why he doesn't come off is that because he has this technovirus that Apocalypse gave, or was it Mr. Sinister? Or was it Apocalypse? See, I don't even have it all. There's Mr. Sinister in there somewhere too with all this. And it's like, he's battling that virus all the time, and that's why, but he should be the most powerful mutant. And in fact, an alternate version of him called X-Man had his own comic for a while where he was the, and it's like, you start explaining it, they're like, I just think Deadpool's funny because he curses a lot.
yeah
but trying to explain some of the backstory of that to someone that doesn't have you know, years of Marvel under their belt is always a fun thing. I really feel like, Patrick, we are earning the functional nerds title of our podcast, maybe more than any other episode. Like, this has been a deep, deep dive with comics and with Star Wars and stuff. I did want to.
You get me on and you get into the really
deep
nerd.
Like, this is, we love this stuff. It's always great. But I did want to you know, your new book, Empress of Forever, that's going to be out on June 18th, as I'm reading the blurb for it, is making a lot more sense to me now as you're talking about all the various things that you're into. And I realize we didn't really, usually in the beginning of the show, we'll talk a little bit about whatever our guest has out there. So maybe taking some of the things that we've been talking about all episode, maybe you can give our listeners a little taste of what Empress of Forever is like and maybe where some of the inspiration for this book came from.
Oh, God, sure. So Empress of Forever is the story of Vivian Liao, who's a sort of tech billionaire super genius in the kind of grim near future. She's racing against a government conspiracy, basically. She wants to save her friends, free her country, and make herself, you know, enormously wealthy and powerful along the way. But before she can finish her plan, she is surprised by something she's never seen before. There's this glowing woman of green light who appears in a server farm where she's just putting the final pieces of her plan into operation. And she, glowing woman, tears Viv's heart out, and then Viv wakes up in a puddle of green goo several thousand years in the future, orbiting a black hole, and needs to figure out where she is, how she got here, and how she's going to get home. The far future galaxy is ruled by an empress who Viv thinks is the person who pulled her forward in time. It's massively post-apocalyptic. There have been waves of civilization that grew up and then were destroyed by mysterious forces, including the empress herself, who now goes around crushing any civilization that gets advanced enough to pose a threat to her. So Viv assembles a team of ragtag individuals. There is a sort of far future space monk who is trying to piece together advanced technology, like the Empress's technology and power, by studying what she and other civilizations have left behind. There's an ancient enemy of the Empress's, this sort of near immortal space pirate who's been imprisoned in a star for several thousand years, and a techno-organic virus sort of person. And a few other folks that she meets along the way, and they go off on a quest to get Viv back into the past and eventually to free all sentient beings.
Awesome. Well, that sounds sounds right up my alley, and I bet many of our listeners too. So
so that's a short book is what I'm hearing, like what, like 500 pages?
Yeah, pages? You know, 700-800 pages, something like that. I mean, what I really wanted, and I think I've done it, is I wanted to fit something that felt like a whole arc of the old Star Wars EU books into a single volume. I wanted to like get in, tell a big story, get out with a galaxy shattering blast. And I think I've done it. I wanted this to have sort of pace and momentum.
Awesome. Wow. Yeah.
It's drawing off of a lot of stuff. A lot of the stuff we've been talking about, honestly, you know, a childhood spent deeply enmeshed in, old West End games, Star Wars role playing, and squad role playing, big space adventure, and that kind of kinetic forward storytelling, and so also a sort of childhood interest in Journey to the West, which is a middle, maybe 16th century Chinese novel, which has this, you know, band of adventurers who are, you know, on this grand quest to, that case, find scriptures. But it's sort of this intense episodic story. It's driven by character dynamics and by people trying to figure out a way to get along and pursue their common goal together in a way that always felt very true to the tradition of grand adventure science fiction, stuff like all Star Wars, Stargate SG-1, Star Trek even. Basically anything that's got star in the title to me.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm a huge Stargate fan too, and it's only a matter of time before I, you know, I'm hoping to get my son onto a lot of these so I can have an excuse to go through 17 seasons of the various Stargate programs again. So that's a reason to have kids, is to try to just, you know, have an excuse to watch
those. Oh, for crying out loud.
You know, I have to say, in the last 5 weeks, doing a lot of sitting on the couch watching Stargate SG-1.
It's nice comfort food, right? Because it's interesting, but if you doze off for a minute, it's okay because you've seen them before, and you know there's a nice kind of structure to them, because it is, you know, we forget. I was talking a few weeks back on the podcast how I'm I've slowed on it recently, but I was rewatching Farscape, and it's the same kind of thing where it's, I watched it all at one point, but in rewatching it, it's like, eh, if you nod off of it, it's okay. You know where it's going, you know, but it feels good to rewatch that stuff too. It's, you don't have to, you know, study every line. It's nice.
So honestly, the sort of embarrassing confession for me is this is my first time through SG-1. And what is striking me is just how good it is. Like, it's the stealing a friend's summary here, but the medium episodes are at worst medium. And the good episodes are really amazing pieces of strong character-driven conceit science fiction. It's interesting watching that next to Star Trek The Next Generation, which my wife and I have also been rewatching recently, where TNG is often really invested in the science fictional solve for the problem. Like, what's going on here? Why is this? What does this alien want? Oh, this alien wants this. We'll give the alien that, and the alien goes away, something like that. Whereas in SG-1, the science fictional conceit is so frequently used to give an excuse for character drama. And then there's a proper science fictional solution to the problem that comes up. So like there's an episode where Teal'c gets infected by an alien bug creature that's going to cause him to, he's going to like aliens inside him and explode into lots of bugs. And it's very sad because we like Teal'c. And this is an occasion for the B plot to be the SG-1 team trying to track down Teal'c, who has run away so that he can die without hurting anyone. And also trying to track down a version of, like a sample of this sort of alien space bug so that they can cure him when they find him. But the A plot is Teal'c like running away to a nearby town and befriending this local girl who like runs around with the super soaker, whose dad is a cop who got shot in the line of duty. And they have this really beautiful kind of touching, snarky back and forth friendship that develops. And I don't know, it's just, the character work is great. The dialogue is fun. The acting is really surprisingly good. I don't want to be negging at all, but like I wasn't expecting walking through to be just really impressed by the actors on a like beat for beat level.
Yeah.
Indeed. So before you go down that road, John, I just want to say I've always felt like since SG-1 came first, but SG-1 Universe, Atlantis, all these shows, and Supernatural figured out, like, they started out in one direction and then they figured out who they were as a show. And they also figured out who their fans were. And they just started doing things for their fans. So over the course of SG-1, there are a lot of fan-centric episodes where they specifically talk to their fans and they're like, we're going to do something really fun for you in this next 45 minutes. Supernatural does the same thing, right? They always have those episodes every year that are, this is for the fans. We're going to take away the very, very serious stuff that we always do. And we're going to do something where we're going to be animated and we're going to be in a Scooby-Doo cartoon. Or, you know, for SG-1, it's like, we're gonna have an episode with a TV show about us. That's not quite us, but we're going to be on set as they're filming this TV show. Really, fans, it's all about you.
Yeah, I was gonna ask Max, right, how far into it are you? How many seasons are you in?
I think we're midway through the second season, so I'm making super fast progress, but we got a long way to go.
And what's cool is you're still in the Showtime years.
Because
this was originally a Showtime series.
Oh, really?
Before it jumped to the channel formerly known as Sci-Fi.
Oh, wow.
They really do a good job of building up a mythology that you're nowhere even near yet. Like they do so many different things that build to this nice, satisfying, the world building and the mythology they build up is really quite great by the time you get towards the end of it. So once you really get into the meat of it, it's quite good.
I'm honestly really impressed already by the slow burn world building of it all. Like they start from jump. Like we have a gate, it goes to stars, goes to this one particular star. That's all. That's the only thing that we know. to, you know, midway through the first season, even they're talking with one alien race about trying to resettle them with another alien race that they ran into 6 weeks ago and trying to figure out where they're going to source enough material to build this other thing. Like, it's just brick by brick. The show doesn't forget anything.
Yeah.
Even the stuff that feels like it's just going to be a one-off. People reference, there's some kind of institutional memory in a way that, you know, Star Trek shows often don't feature.
Yeah.
And my other thing that John and I have always talked about is I feel like that particular show really gets going when they take the reins off of Richard Dean Anderson and they let him be Richard Dean Anderson.
Yeah, he's really good on that. I enjoyed him quite a bit on that. Now, now I just want to rewatch Stargate now, because I didn't watch it when it first aired. That was an early, Stargate SG-1 was an early Netflix streaming property. When I first started using Netflix, whenever streaming started, and I'm like, oh, this is a show I always wanted to watch. Boom, 10 seasons later or whatever. And yeah, and then you'll flow right into Atlantis and Universe too, because they just kind of keep building on the same world building and mythology. So it's cool. Well, we are just about out of time. Max, thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm excited about the new book, Empress of Forever. I think our listeners are going to love it. I think I'm going to love it. So I'm really looking forward to
I hope you do. It's a lot of fun.
Before we go, are you going to be making any con appearances coming up?
I am going to be a little short on cons this summer. My wife and I just had a kid, so that's curtailing travel.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Very exciting, very exhausting and exhilarating all at the same time. So I'm going to be launching Empress of Forever in Pandemonium Books and Games in Cambridge, Massachusetts on June 20th. And I'm going to also have another book coming out a little bit later this summer with Amal Mukhtar called This Is How You Lose the Time War, which is another whole thing, which is amazing and a lot of fun. So we're going to be watching that also in sort of Cambridge and then in New York a little bit later. But as for cons, I'll be at ReaderCon and I will probably be at World Fantasy in Los Angeles this year. And that's it for the immediate future.
Cool. All right. So everyone, check out Max's new book, and you can follow him on Twitter at Max Gladstone, and you can go to his website, maxgladstone.com. For us, once again, thanks for backing the show if you already are. And if you're not, just go to patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Summer is here. Get out and do something.
Indeed. Indeed. All right, everybody. Have a great week. We'll see you next time.
Smoke.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.